Welcome to the Creative Pursuit Podcast. In each episode, we chat with entrepreneurs and freelancers in the creative field. We dive into how they got started and how they grew their business to provide you with insights and motivation so that you too can pursue your creative passion. We believe you should enjoy the work you do and that the biggest challenge is to just get started. Check out our website, creativepursuit.co, for show notes and more info about the creatives featured in each episode. Now, here's your host, Darren Young.
Thanks for tuning in to the Creative Pursuit Podcast. I'm Darren Young, and I am the owner of Mix Media, which does web design, videography, and marketing technology. This episode of Creative Pursuit is sponsored by Millennifits. Millennifits wants everyone to do what they love, but since doing what you love doesn't always come with benefits, Millennifits provides work for benefits. By helping a local business with their digital marketing for just a few hours each week, you receive healthcare, retirement, or student loan benefits. Join the Millennifits community and also help your local community. Find out more at millennifits.com. That's millennifits.com. And be sure to follow Millennifits on Instagram. Millennifits, benefits for the way we work in the new millennium. On this episode, I have Kita Mascaro of Kita Mascaro Productions. Kita currently does videography and photography, but the path leading up to his current work has been a rather intriguing and sometimes unbelievable journey. Kita's experiences range from being in a band, a personal chef to celebrities, and also teaching. But he explains how all of this relates to his current work in feature films, which just goes to show you that pursuing a career in the creative field is not always a smooth ride, but each point can be another step towards your goal. And lastly, just so you know, this episode contains some mature language. Okay, let's get started. Hey everyone, thanks for tuning in to the Creative Pursuit Podcast. Today I have with me Kita Mascaro of Kita Mascaro Productions. Hey Kita, how's it going?
Good, how are you?
I'm doing good. Thanks for coming down today and joining me. I know we've been talking about this for a while, but glad to finally have you in the room with me.
Yeah, this is really exciting.
So let's get into what you currently do. So tell us about Kita Mascaro Productions.
Well, right now, where would I start with this? My focus primarily right now is fictional narrative, whether it's episodic narrative or fictional, you know, filmmaking is my main focus right now. The last 5-6 years I've been doing commercials, everything from Walmart commercials to, you know, television down to mostly what I do is, I would say, you know, product stuff, startup, tech, you know, in that space, doing video content, some photography. And about 2 years ago, I kind of decided that what I'd really like to do is get into episodic and fictional, you know, fictional narrative content. The main reason being is that, you know, right now I'm 43 and I'm at a place in my life where I, you know, with commercials, you make a commercial, you turn it in, you get a check, and then it's dead on arrival. And, you know, so for the future, you know, what I really want to be doing is producing content that you get residual income from. And the only way you can do that in this field that I can see is doing narrative, fictional narrative, intellectual property. So that's really where I'm focused right now, is curating fictional narrative content at the moment.
So I want to get into the fictional narrative after this, but getting back to the commercials you've done. So commercials, there is no royalty structure for that?
No, not for content creators. I don't even know with actors nowadays, not on the level that I'm doing them. There's not even for the actors. It used to be that the actors could get residuals when the commercials air.
So even if you see like a famous actor, like if Samuel Jackson does a commercial, he just gets paid for the commercial, but not the replay.
He'll probably get residuals, okay, just because that's such a high profile talent. But like, you know,
for the people behind the scenes, it's just you get paid for the work and then that's it.
Yeah. Making a Roush Honda commercial, which I've made a number of, it's like, you know, those you get paid when you turn them in, and you know, I pay everybody that works with me, and then basically you cash a check and it's over.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, I think in commercials, there is some creativity involved, but you are working under a strict guidelines probably given to you by the the company that's hiring you, right?
Yeah, and it's not a creative issue for me, because you can be really creative with commercials, and I don't mind that. And I think that something that's nice about commercials too is their restrictive nature. There's a lot of
time
and one of the most exciting things when I was making the Walmart commercials, I made 24 Walmart commercials over a period of 2.5 years. And that was really, really exciting because, and I had never anticipated this, but it's in television, you have to be, the commercial has to be 30 seconds to the frame. So it can't be one frame over or under 30 seconds exactly. And so it's really exciting in that particular campaign. You know, I had to, there was the intro, there was the middle section and the outro, and everything was unscripted. So what you had to do is you had to make sure the intro was roughly 5 to 6 seconds long. You had to make sure the outro was roughly 7 to 8 seconds long. And then the middle, which was composed in three, it was basically three chunks in the middle, that middle section could only be about 14 or 15 seconds long. In order to make a 30 second.
And you got to leave room for the ending screen, right? The closing screen?
Yeah, the closing screen could be over top of the audio. So strictly speaking, audio-wise, it needed to be 5-6 second intro, 15 second middle, 7 to 8 second outro. And so when we were shooting it on set, what we'd have to do is I would have someone, usually the script soup. We didn't really have a script supervisor because it was unscripted, but we had someone that was, you know, there just dedicated to continuity and all that. And they would usually sit there with a stopwatch, and we would do take after take after take of the intro and the outro. And if it was over five or, you know, in the script notes, I would have them write down exactly what second it was. So every single take, I would know in my head which takes I liked, and then I would say, you know, mark that take. But every single take would also have a second count. So if the intro was 8 seconds long, there was no way I could use it. And, it, you know, if the outro was too long. And that was really interesting because you'd have all these clips at the end of the day, and it wasn't necessarily the best clips that you put in for any one part of the commercial, because sometimes you put the best clips together and as shaved down as you could make it, it's 32 seconds long. So that's 2 seconds you have to take from somewhere. And in editing that, it's like if you took it from one chunk and replaced it, that almost always would affect all the other, I keep on whacking this, I'm Italian, that would affect all the other chunks, and you'd have, I mean, it was a nightmare. There were some times where I would spend, because the way the day would work is we'd get up at 7 a.m, be on set. We'd shoot the entire day. Then I would race home, and I would have to have an approved edit by the end of the day.
Oh, really? Wow, yeah. That quick of a turnaround?
Yeah, because we would shoot on Tuesday. The commercial would air on Thursday morning.
Wow.
So what we'd have to do is we'd have to go shoot, and then we'd shoot all day on Tuesday. Then as I was driving home, I'd be editing in the car while someone else was driving. And then I'd throw the edits in, and then we'd send them back to LA. And sometimes you'd go back and forth with the preliminary edit. It could be 6 or 7 different cuts by the time you get an approval from LA, and then they would send it to Walmart. And then the next day you'd wait to hear Walmart's feedback, and then you'd have to do more edits to get it approved. And then it would have to be turned in by Wednesday evening so that they could turn around and have it on TV. On Thursday. It was a less than 2-day turnaround.
So I haven't worked on any commercial shoots myself, and I think other people listening would be curious as well. So is this a common practice, like this type of quick turnaround?
I'm not an expert in it, but the reason, and this is kind of an interesting historical, as far as the commercials go, usually if you had like a high budget, you know, high concept commercial, you'd probably have a couple of days depending on what the content was, probably have two or three days, maybe a week to shoot it, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars budget. These commercials took advantage of DSLRs and their ability to create broadcast quality content. So because of that, the workflow the immediacy of a DSLR camera, the 5Ds that came out, that allowed for companies like a Walmart to make a quick turnaround commercial that was high enough quality to go on TV. And so to my knowledge, this one particular Walmart campaign was the first campaign to really utilize a DSLR technology and the ability to turn, you know, to have a very quick turnaround. And it was a nightmare, but it was also really fun because it kind of felt like, in a sense, it kind of felt like, you know, 48-hour film festival, but it was a commercial. And every week, what was really neat is that we were making, it was a national campaign, but they were shot regionally. And so it's a pretty brilliant campaign. And so what would happen is every week, we'd shoot every other week, generally. And so every week there would be up to 20 other markets in the country that were shooting at the same time. And so what we'd get to do is during our edits, we would have all the edits on the same, it was a Wistia account. So we'd be able to go in there and not only look at our edits, but we'd also be able to see other people's commercials and their edits. And it was really, really fun because we'd, you know, every region had a host and had a different filmmaker making the commercials in those zones. And everybody had their own kind of flavor to how they made their commercial, even though it was highly structured. And, you know, there wasn't a lot of room for creativity because they had to, there hadn't needed to be a continuity, but you could definitely see people's, you know, we were in control of the color correction. So everybody's color was a little, you know, specific to what their preference was. And everybody had different hosts. Some of the hosts were really great. Some of the hosts were awful. you know, most were average. I had a really amazing host. I was lucky. We had like a really fun host that did really well with his lines. And also I did all the casting for my market. Like there was a casting producer for each market, but it was such a low paying job that most of the times they would just get crappy. You know, it was women running around shopping. So most of the markets didn't have the best participants. But I kind of, when I got the job, I told them I wanted to do all the casting too. So I took that over for my market, and it was really great because then I was able to control, you know, have a little bit more control over who was going to be in front of the camera.
And also make it easier because you probably work with these people before too.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. Usually, if you had a casting producer who would get you, it was four women per commercial. And if you had a casting producer, basically they were people that these women are coming out, they're real people. They weren't, you couldn't use models. So they would come to set and it would be, you know, as you can imagine.
You have to like tell them, you got to go here, you got to do this. You have every step by step, right?
Yeah, and they'd be really, really uncomfortable, you know, because it's like they're not actors, they're real people and they're, you know, they're nervous. What was nice about me doing the casting is that I was the director slash producer on these things. So I was pretty much in charge of the whole shoot. So if I was casting, it got, and I'm really good with people, I love people. So it was, I could get them comfortable before. So when they got on set, it's like the most, you know, the person with the most authority on the set was also the person that cast them. So they, it made them more comfortable, I thought. And I thought it translated into the, you know, it translated in the commercial because instead of being on set and being totally freaked out by all these people that they don't know, they knew me. And I took that really seriously. And I think it worked out for my market, you know?
So you said you were doing, I think you said 24 commercials. So if you're doing this every other week, so that was like pretty much your whole year for 1 year?
They went and, it was every other week, but we had months that were off. So it, all in all, it was about 2 years, 2.5 years of commercials. Okay. So it wasn't always regular. There were chunks of time where we had black weeks, you know. But yeah, it was, and I did some other markets too. I went to Louisville and Cleveland and Minneapolis and shot some there too.
So, but these commercials, when you're doing these for Walmart, when were this? When was this?
This was 2013 through 15.
Okay. And that was, you were here in Columbus?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
But so the markets I was in were, it was, well, I worked with Dayton and Columbus were my two primary markets, but then I also, Minneapolis, Louisville, and Cleveland.
Okay, wow, it's a pretty big stretch.
Yeah, it was really exciting. I mean, it was one of the most exciting. I hate Walmart, but it was really, but I used it. It was kind of a dance with the devil. I learned a lot about filmmaking and, you know, a ton. You know, it's funny because when I was a kid, you know, I come from a punk rock tradition, and I would have punched myself if I had known I would have done anything with Walmart. But it was, in my own way, my favorite thing is that I cast for Columbus and Dayton, and my big fuck you to Walmart was that I one of my best friends is the manager of Cahoots, which is a strip club in town, and I know a lot of the girls that dance there. And I cast, I believe, 4 or 5 women out of there that ended up making the commercial. So about 4 or 5 commercials in Columbus featured a stripper, which I'm very proud of.
And Walmart had no idea.
Had no idea, no. And they were great commercials because they're, you know, they're friends of mine, and, you know, they need the money. I mean, the thing that was really exciting about the job, probably my favorite thing about the job, was in casting, what you were doing is you were giving a woman. Most Walmarts are on the outskirts of town. They're not in the center of town. So they're like small towns and suburbs. And so what you're doing is you're giving an opportunity. When you're casting the moms, you're giving usually an opportunity to a woman who has kids. And the typical woman that was cast was a woman in her 30s who had, you know, 2 to 4 kids and married her high school sweetheart who's not interested in her anymore. It was a really fascinating psychological study, you know, and they all had a breakout fantasy, it seemed. And in general, you know, they had, and this commercial opportunity represented this kind of special place that they could go, you know, where they could be paid attention. You know, it's like in their mid 30s, it's like, you know, they're not getting the attention from their husbands half the time. The kids don't care. And so you've got this, like, you know, and now it's funny because 20 years ago when those women were coming up, it's like there was no real internet to speak of. It was like, you know, you basically grew up, if you grew up in the country, you were in the country and you didn't really have a lot of exposure, you know, whereas now, you know, with, you know, YouTube and computers and the news and digital everything, it's like you could live in the middle of fucking nowhere but be completely exposed to the world around you. And, you know, think about that woman who 20, 25 years ago got married to her high school sweetheart living in a small town, maybe having a far-off dream of getting out of the town, but, like, you know, you don't take that seriously and your exposure is so limited. Now that person can be just as plugged in as anybody who's in LA or New York. And so it's like all of a sudden, and, you know, 25 years ago, there were no dating apps. There were no, yeah. I mean, you know, the access to high school sweetheart was the hottest dude you were probably ever going to see, right? Or have access to. Mm-hmm. Now you can go on Tinder and meet whoever.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Or whatever. So you have these women that I think, I don't know, this is just my observation, but it was, you have these women with these serious breakout
desires.
And I think people always have a breakout desire, but the difference is that the access to what the other could be is so close now. And so you have these women that, like, 20 years ago wouldn't have even thought about LA or getting out or being in a commercial or anything like that. And now it's like they're itching. They want to get out and see the world, and they're stuck. They have kids that, you know, and they have a husband that doesn't care. And, you know, here I come with a camera and my goofiness, and, you know, they're like, what the fuck's going on? And Walmart commercial, they all shop at Walmart, right? It becomes this crazy opportunity. And also they get paid $500. So they're on TV and they get money. And it wasn't lost on me that a good number of the people that I cast, it was like, this was not only was this the most exciting thing that was going to happen that year, this is like one of the most exciting things that was going to be happen in their lifetime.
Yeah. Something that they will always remember.
Yeah. And that $500, I mean, there were a lot of women that I cast that was the difference between them being able to buy a Christmas present for one of their kids. You know, and that's, I don't live in that world. I don't have kids. I'm a city, I've lived in cities almost my whole life. You know, I get by, it's so not my reality. You know what I mean? I don't think about that. And it was really humbling being in a scenario where it's like you had that ability to give something that, to me, it's like, I don't give a fuck about Walmart commercials or TV or whatever, but that doesn't mean that there aren't people that do give a fuck about that. And to me, it was really, that's where the soul of that came in for me. That's where I found my feet in those commercials, because I hate big corporations and I'm not a Walmart fan at all and all that stuff. But being able to see the impact that commercial could make on one person and the message we could tell in the storytelling was really special. And it was really exciting. And it was really exciting to be able to put strippers in.
I mean, yeah, well, that's really interesting. I mean, I would never have put that much thought behind all those things that are leading up to a shoot like that and all the things that go behind it. But yeah, that's a good perspective on it. Yeah.
And you wouldn't know, I wouldn't have that perspective either until I was in it. Uh-huh. When I got the opportunity, it was just one of those, like, do you want to make, you know, some commercials? And I was like, oh, you know what I mean? But yeah. I was like, oh, I'm just going to have to dance with the devil a little bit to figure this out. It didn't even occur to me that there was going to be all this rich, you know, underbelly.
So let's go back to how you got started. What was your background, or how did you get into video?
That goes way back. In 98, I had a band in LA. I moved from New York City to Los Angeles in 98. I had a band for a few years, and the band fell apart in the early 2000s. And that's right when DSLRs started coming out, the Canon GL1 or something.
Yeah. But I believe for just photography, the DSLRs, there was no video function yet.
Oh, actually, no, it wasn't a DS. Sorry, it was a digital video cam.
Oh, you mean
not DSLRs?
Away,
yeah.
Are you talking about the ones with the DV tapes, or the one
the DV tapes?
Away? Okay, yeah.
Yeah. I think it was the GL. There was the XL1. Which
I just remember Canon had that. That was the one camera everyone had. It was like this kind of white and red color. Yeah.
That was the XL1. Mm-hmm. We had the GL1, which was the shitty version of that, and we made a film. We, you know, the band broke up and we were really interested in, actually I have a funny story with this. So my lead singer was obsessed with this band called Jay and the Americans, which was a doo-wop band in the 60s. So he had this idea to write a script about, like, basically a fictional, semi-fictionalized version of their real life story that involved the mafia. Because in real life, there was kind of a mafia issue with the lead singer, but it's not like, you know, it's all hearsay, it's not confirmed. And so what we did is, and we, when we were in college in New York, we went and saw Jay and the Americans play a few times, and it was really exciting and fun. But, you know, I like the music, This Magic Moment. They made their stamp with This Magic Moment and Karamia and a couple other, Only in America. So what happened is, the band broke up, and I don't know what happened in between then and when, but starting in 2001, we put together the script, and the lead singer wrote it. The GL1 came out, we bought it.
How much did that cost at that time?
God, I don't even know. $2,000?
$2,000, three, okay, grand, yeah, I mean, that's still a decent investment.
Maybe $4,000, it was somewhere between $2,000 and $4,000. Yeah, it wasn't that cheap at all, especially back then. That's 20 years ago almost. So then what we did is we decided to make this film. It was like a 60 minute, not quite a feature, but not really a short. And it was called Only in America, and it was based loosely on the real life band, right? So we made the film. We shot it at a combination of my house in Hollywood, and I had a little bungalow and some other random places around town. We must have had 50 people on the cast and crew. It was insane. And we had, back then we had to have editors, because back then to edit a film, you couldn't edit on like a normal desktop. You had to have like some monster fucking computer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely.
I mean, it would take like, what would take 5 minutes to render today would take literally all day long to render then. It's just amazing how different. And this was standard definition. This wasn't even high def, you know?
Yeah, there was no such thing yet.
No,
yeah.
No. And so we made the film. It took us months to edit. So the film comes out. It's a piece, total piece of shit. It's like horrendous. I acted in it. My buddy acted. He played the lead singer. It was totally funny. We recreated all these sets in my house. It was really funny. Total fun. So then we made a bunch of tapes and we had a huge screening and we made 100 tapes for people. It cost $500. So then one day we were in Amoeba Records, maybe 2 weeks, 3 weeks after we shot this thing. And we start seeing the tapes for sale at Amoeba Records. So some bastard on our set, and we didn't get, now here's the thing, we did like two or three of the songs, we lip synced them, and these are songs that were written by Lieber and Stoller. Uh-huh, so these are like highly, highly, highly registered, these aren't like obscure, these are like total lockdown.
Yeah, you don't want to even get close to those, right?
No, you don't, I mean, you know. What we did technically was a huge issue. But, you know, we were just like, look, it's a stupid start out film. We weren't even thinking about it. We're like, you know, bad publicity is good publicity, you know. Well, so so they start selling these at Amoeba. Because at Amoeba Records in Hollywood, you can literally anything on a tape or a DVD or anything media, you can go in there and sell it to them. And then they'll resell it. And so we're sitting there and we start seeing our tape. Some poor asshole on our set sold the tape probably for $1, and now they're selling it for $6 in Amoeba Records, which kind of pissed us off because we didn't make any money off of this thing. And now some, you know, Amoeba's making money off of our thing. But it was also really flattering because it's like, oh, no way, it's for sale in Amoeba Records. And so, but here's the funny thing. So Jay and the Americans has like a rabid following. Huge, huge, crazy following. Now, they're not huge like in numbers, but like...
And there's a small following, but they're very, very loyal.
Yes, mm-hmm. Yes. And they're all like now, they're probably all in their 60s and 70s. They're all in New York. Because back then, Jay and the Americans was a dude. That was like AM days when like you had regional. So Jay and the Americans, even though they had some national hits, but really they were more of a regional. They were an East Coast doo-wop band. Because in the 60s, most of the doo-wop bands were either a Detroit band, an East Coast band, or a West Coast doo-wop because of AM radio. And they would all have the same, like Lieber and Stoller would write a hit song. And then that's why you have so many, you'll have like a song that three or four different bands made their name off of. It was because of AM radio. So anyway, so they have this rabid fan base. Well, unbeknownst to us, put up one of our tapes on eBay, had no idea, and it went up to, I think, $60. Someone bought the fucking a tape on eBay. So I had no idea. So
how did you find out that it was being sold?
Oh, this is, I'm getting to it. So what happened was on the tape, so we made this really professional tape. With it looked like a real movie, mm-hmm. Because we're Josh, the singer, is a graphic designer, and so we designed this really beautiful, kind of looked like a real movie. And so what we did, but I put my phone number on it. Thank God. So what happened was, so we get a phone call from New York one day, and this woman, I answer it, and this woman's on the line. She's like, "Hey," I was like, "You know, I saw that, you know, I'm a huge Jay and the Americans fan. There's this number on the back. It was your number. Like, I was wondering if you could sell us the, you know, there was a tape on eBay. I didn't win it, but I was wondering if we could buy one." And I was like, "You're kidding." I was like, "There was one on eBay." And they're like, "Yeah, well, I'm a part of the Jay and the Americans fan club. And the woman who won it is the head of the fan club. And, you know, but we want to know if there's more and is there, can we buy them?" And I was like, "This is insane." So I was like, I mean, it made sense, but we weren't even thinking about that, right? And so I was like, sure. Well, you know, I was like, I can't sell you one. Thank fucking God I said that. I was like, we can't sell you one, but we can, you know, because we don't own the rights to the music or anything. I was like, but, you know, give me your address and your name and I'd be happy to send you a copy, you know? So we're talking. I was like, oh, so how do you know Jay and the Americans, blah, blah, blah. And like, she's from New York and she grew up listening to them, blah, blah, blah. About half an hour into this conversation, she's like, okay. She's like, I'm going to admit something to you. And I was like, what? She's like, well, she's like, actually, I'm the secretary for Jay and the Americans. And I was like, what? And she's like, yeah, I'm Kenny Vance's secretary, who's the band leader of Jay and the Americans. She's like, I was investigating because what happened was is the woman who won the tape was the leader of our fan page or group or whatever. And she alerted us that there's this unauthorized biography, fictional biography of the band, and was like alerting us and this and that. And so we, of course, got freaked out but your number was on there. So we wanted to call to see what was going on. And I was like, oh my God. I was like, you know, well, this is the deal. I mean, we made this film. It was just to kind of jumpstart our careers. I was like, you know, I'd be happy to. I'm like, we're not making any money off of it. We didn't get rights to anything, obviously, which is why you're calling. And I was like, but you know, I'd be happy to send you a bunch of tapes for all the band members. We'd love to see what the reaction is. And she's like, sure, send them. And so we sent the 5 tapes to this woman or 10 tapes. I don't know. We sent them a bunch of tapes and it was awesome because the band was like, loved it. I mean, even though it was like a horrible quality, I wouldn't want anybody to see it. But it was so fun. I mean, luckily we did not get sued. Nothing happened.
Yeah, I mean, fortunately, you unknowingly told the truth, and so you didn't get a lawsuit on your hands.
Oh, thank God, I didn't say.
Yeah.
If I had told her,
yep,
that you can buy it for $1, I'd probably be in jail right now. I would have, you know, they would have sent a cease and desist. They didn't even send us that. I mean, they just didn't.
I mean, that is good because she probably saw that you're completely transparent and
yeah, really we were just trying to get our career going, and it was all in good fun.
Yeah. So anyways, I mean, so that.
Sorry for the long story. It's a long story, but it's funny.
Yeah, no, that's a really interesting story. But anyway, so that story. So from there, is that what kind of leapfrogged you into getting into video or?
Well, yeah, video. I did mostly video art, though. I did a lot of conceptual art, video installations. I really liked the idea of being in films. I was studying a lot of Cassavetes at the time and you know, Jim Jarmusch, Bergman. Those were like some, you know, that's on the filmmaking end. Of course, Woody Allen is like one of my all-time favorites. I was also really heavily getting into Warhol, studying a lot of Paul Morrissey, you know, 60s filmmakers, Jack Smith, who's from Columbus, actually. So I got really interested in like kind of more abstract, but not like structuralist video, more like cinema verite kind of style of filmmaking. So I got into that, and that's really where I spent most of my time in the 2000s was making that type of work. And then didn't make any money, obviously. I had a really high-end catering company in LA, and I was cooking for that was a weird kind of thing I fell into, but I ended up cooking for Rod Stewart for 8 years. And that, yeah, I just like totally, that's a weird story that I just kind of fell into. I was cooking for my cousin. He had art openings in LA. He was there doing fine art, and I used to cook. We're Italian, so I used to cook all these things. Then one day one of his clients came up to me and was like, hey, can you cook a Korean wedding? And I lived in Koreatown, so on the outskirts in Hollywood. So I was like, sure, that makes sense. I can cook Korean food. Which I didn't know jack shit about.
Yeah, I was gonna ask you, did you?
No. I just bullshitted and I said yes. And I made some curry and I got a book. I went to a Korean restaurant hoping that they would help, you know, that would be. And basically they didn't, in Koreatown, they don't speak any English at all. And they don't really care that much about white people. And so, so I went, especially idiot white people, which was, it's, I walk in and I'm like trying to get some ideas. And the only thing that happened is they put a whole fried fish on a plate and gave it to me with some like kimchi. And I was like, this is not going to work. And so I had to go to Barnes and Noble's and get some books on Asian food. And so I made a curry. I made all kinds of stuff and got them really drunk. And it worked. Made $500. Then I took the $500 and I got a chef outfit. And I went, and in LA, there's these agencies for rich people that, you know, any kind of person that a rich person needs in their house, they place these people. So it's mostly nannies and valets and maitre d's and shit like that. Yeah, but they chefs and gardeners and all that stuff. So they have these, there are like three or four agencies in LA for that. So I went in and I'm like in this new jacket. And I, at the time, I still had my mohawk and I was like punk rocked out. And I was like, yeah, I'm a celebrity chef, blah, blah, blah. And people are like, you're full of shit. Get out of here. And this one guy was like, okay, you're full of it. But I have a client that needs a Thanksgiving dinner. Can you, this is like in 1999, I think. And he's like, you know, can you go cook a turkey? And I was like, I can get cook turkeys and hams and I can cook all kinds of shit. And he's like, just cook turkey, you know? And it's, so I went over and it was Rachel Hunter, who was Rod's wife at the time, but they were separated. And she's like not much older than me. So she was probably still in her 20s at the time. So I went over there, cooked the craziest thing, got all my hot friends, guys and girls, the hottest people I knew as my waiters and bartenders. And I took the $500 that I was going to make off the gig and I put it into food and I made this huge spread and the best food I could make and it was crazy and everybody went nuts. So then 2 weeks later, I got a phone call from Rod Stewart's assistant saying, Mr. Stewart would like you up at the house for a test dinner. And I was like, sure. And I'm like high off of this, right? So we're driving up, my buddy and I are driving up Mulholland Drive, and I had a Buick that was like a mile long at the time. We're driving up Mulholland Drive with all this food. Then like I pull over on the side of the road and I'm like, what the fuck are we doing? And he's like, we're going to Ron's house. I'm like, exactly. I'm like, we can't do that. This is not even, I had like one of those moments of like reality just hit me in the face. Check. And was like, what in the world am I doing? Like, this is, I'm not even qualified to do this, right? And so he was like, you have to do it, and we have to do it. And I was like, all right, whatever. I just wanted to go back down the hill and just eat the steaks and then call it a day and not answer our phones. I got freaked out. And but anyway, so we went and cooked. And at the end of the meal, Rod came into the kitchen totally drunk and was like, you're my new chef. And so we and that started my career of cooking, which was really, it is intimately linked to the art, because I ended up cooking. All my clients are celebrities.
Wow, that's amazing.
It was amazing. It was really fun because I hired all, because if it was a musician that I was cooking for, I'd hire all my music related friends. And then if it wasn't, like, I cooked for Tarantino during Kill Bill, so if it was for Tarantino and Lawrence Bender, I would have all my acting friends come over. I got people auditions. I mean, it was insane. It was totally insane. And a lot of work, but it was great because I could make a big chunk of money in like a 3-day chunk of work, and it allowed me all this time to make my work and not worry about the money. So that was like a real accidental career that was really helpful, because I spent, you know, I made artwork for 10 years and never once had to worry about selling anything. Which, I don't know, that could have been a problem. Maybe it would have been beneficial if I had to sell stuff, because maybe I would have made money earlier.
At the time, so you were doing this catering and cooking, so that was like your main
job, income,
and you're still doing art in your spare time?
Oh, yeah. Well, I had tons of time now that I didn't have a 9-to-5. You know, in LA, you don't really want to have a 9-to-5.
Yeah, yeah.
You don't want to have any job, really. You want to be able to do your work all the time. But if you have to work, you want to make as much money. If you don't have someone, you know, you're fucking for your income, which I wasn't lucky enough to have, then you had to basically find some way to make a chunk of money to get by. Because, you know, otherwise you're working 5 days a week doing something and then you're coming home. Mm-hmm. And you know, it's like, it's too much.
Yeah. Then when or how did you transition from cooking into video production?
Well, it became professional after grad school. So I went to grad school. I came back to Ohio.
For video production?
No, I got my MFA. And okay. So it was a fine art, degree. I wanted to study with Ann Hamilton. I got a full ride, I was really fortunate to get accepted to OSU. And they had a teaching fellowship, which was nice. So I learned to teach. Well, I mean, I didn't really learn to teach. They don't teach you how to teach. They just, you go up. I mean, for me, I just went up and told stories and, tried to cheerlead.
And motivate,
And motivate people to make something that meant something to them. That was all I did, really. Because really, to be honest with you, half the kids knew more than I did about photography. I mean, I remember the funniest thing. I was trying to teach them about a hot shoe. But I had never known that that was what it was called, a hot shoe. I thought it was called a horseshoe. Well, I was reading about it. And I mean, I had used them. I didn't know what the fuck it was called. And I'm sitting up there talking about the horseshoe.
And then someone raises their hand.
Yeah. And this student who is really sweet, but knew the fuck out of cameras. And he raised his hand and he's like, do you mean hot shoe? And I was like, no, that's another part of the camera. And then that's what it meant. It was so funny. I mean, I didn't even pretend it. I'm like, I don't, just pick up the damn thing. And it's not about the camera. It's about what you're looking at. It's like the car. Mm-hmm. I told him it was about cars, Like when you're 16, you don't give a shit about the car.
Yeah, you just as long
you
as you
care about
drive.
Where you're going. You know what I mean? When I was 16, there was no Facebook, there wasn't no computers, right? So like your car was your Facebook and Twitter account, And so all you cared is that the four wheels worked and that they had enough gas to get where you wanted to go. So the same with the cameras. I don't care about the camera. What I care about is where the camera will take me, and that's what I tried to talk about in class was like, concentrate on where you want the camera to take you. Don't worry about the camera because you'll learn if you're passionate about what you're putting the camera on, then that will teach you how to shoot photography. No one taught me how to shoot photography,
Yeah.
My interest in shooting something, my interest in what the camera was on is what taught me how to shoot.
So when you were going to grad school, you didn't study video, it was just more of an arts type of focus, but not...
Yeah, no, I never studied video, it's obvious now because I barely know how to use my cameras, but...
But I guess you had enough experience, you've done enough shoots that you've figured out the techniques and...
Yeah, and I'm not really, I had this conversation at the meeting I was at before this. I'm not, there's two paths. There's the technical path in production, or there's the creative path in production. When you start out, you're overlapping.
Yeah,
you have to
be
everything.
Yep.
Usually, unless you go to a technical school and you learn a very specific skill. And
unless you become like a specific, a colorist or the cameraman itself, and that's only all you do. But
yeah, and I didn't go to school, so for that, so what I did is I learned everything. But what you really want to do is kind of isolate. Isolate as quickly as possible what side of that fence your strength is. Is it the creative side, which is more producing, directing, or is it the technical side, which is camera operator, gaffer, sound engineer? Yes, those people can be creative, and yes, you need to have some technical acumen to when you're a producer to make your job easier. But you're generally going to be on one side or the other unless you're doing small potato stuff.
Yeah.
I am much more creative side of things. I'm really bad with technical.
Yeah, I know we talked before, and that's why you're, I guess now, or you have been currently trying to transition into more the director's role of things, right?
Yeah, all I care about right now is directing and producing. Mm-hmm. I don't really want to learn any more about cameras, to be honest.
Okay, so yeah, let's get into that. So what are you, I know you've been working on a film, what have you been working on and what's coming up for you?
Well, right now we just got done shooting the film called Six, which I produced with four other people. That's exciting. It's just about to, we have a Netflix deal and it's got a theatrical release and limited at first. We're hoping it goes.
Is this a feature film, or is it more of a TV type of episode type of?
No, it's a feature film in its current form, and it's set up to be franchised out. Actually, one of our producers and one of our executive producers are connected to a man in Southern California who's an exorcist specialist. He comes from the Philippines, and he, really interesting human, very out there, has, you know, is a mystic of sorts and a spiritual medium. And basically, they own the intellectual property of his stories. And so what we did is we took, I don't think it's anywhere near literal, but I'm not too sure with that. But we basically, he has all these stories, and even if they were halfway true, make fantastic topics for film. And so for a horror film. And so this film was basically structured to be one of a series of installments of his diaries.
Do you have like a
release date?
Yeah, release date.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's supposed to come out for our Netflix deal. It's supposed to come out at the end of the year. Okay. It has to come out this fiscal, like 2017.
And so where are you guys on it right now? What stage are you in?
We're going into editing.
Okay.
Into post.
How long do you think that's going to take you? Or when is your deadline?
It's going to be less than, it's not going to be longer than 6 months.
Yeah.
Yeah, which is a pretty quick turnaround. I'd like to see it in the theater around Halloween would be great, but I'd be very surprised if we were able to turn it around, because we still have a few pickup shots that we have to get in. And editing a feature is very mm-hmm. complicated, especially on that level. It's a $650,000 film. That's a lot of content. We shot for 25 days. That's like a huge chunk.
And how many people are, not only your production crew, but how many actors or how many people were involved total?
There were probably 70 total people.
Wow.
I would say 40, 50 crew members on any given day. Well, there were a lot more than 70, because we had a lot of extras and actors that are like, you know, supporting. Our main actors are probably 7-8 actors. We brought in 5 from LA. So some people with name value. Yeah, it was a huge, huge endeavor. It was kind of overwhelming, to be honest.
I can imagine.
It was like drinking out of a fire hydrant. It was a lot of work, and you know, I learned a ton, because I've never been to film school, and you know, this was, you know, every aspect of my brain and skill set and ability to problem solve, for sure.
So were you the director, or what was your role?
No, I directed the sizzle reels and uh-huh. produced the sizzle reels with our other core members. I produced this.
Okay.
You know, I was one of the producers. But in reality, what that meant for me on this particular production is I was kind of the utility bench producer. You know, there were two executive producers that brought all the money to the table, which is very important. And then Chris Freeman was the director / other producer. And then there was a producer that was brought in there were three producers and two executive producers. The team that put it together were four of us in Ohio. There was a producer brought in from LA that got us the name talent, which was really helpful. My job was really more to put out fires and to stop gap anything. Because, you know, I didn't have the experience that the other ones had. So I was, you know, I did a ton of location
scouting.
I did location scouting. I did a lot more of the heavy lifting at the front end of the film, with locations, with initial casting, with putting the ideas together, helping Chris figure out what we were doing. Once we started shooting, then it was like I was like the mop-up guy. I mean, you know, because someone has to do, you know, which was fine, because it allowed me to kind of really see how, you know, I was hoping to be able to direct it, but I wasn't, you know, they couldn't use me to direct it for a number of reasons, mainly just because I didn't have, we had a high enough echelon of talent that in order for them to be on the project, they required an experienced director, which makes sense. I'm experienced, but with commercials and with my own stuff, not with, I've never shot it. And so, you know, that was fine. As long as I was above the line, which I was with the producer, and it gave me enough access to see, because for me, I'm, you know, I love directing and that's probably my favorite thing to do. But what I really, really want to do with my future is put together projects. And so what's more important for me right now is to learn all the aspects of putting the film together, not just directing, because directing is a lot more focused in a specific, you know, in a specific area of the film, whereas like producing, it's like you're literally dealing with everything from the talent down to where's the porta potty, you know what I mean? Like it, which literally happened one day. It was so funny. We were getting to a location and we had a lot of issues with locations, and they were switching and we had to switch a few locations and switch the days out. And so one thing that got overlooked one particular day was that I showed up on set really early and there was the porta potty guy came with a truck and I thought what he was doing was like changing them out or whatever. And I didn't pay much attention to it because I was looking, running around looking for where we can put up the tents and all that. Then I was like, I got to pee. So I go looking for the porta potties and they're gone. And I was like, where the fuck did that guy put the porta potties, right? And it's like, in a half an hour, there are going to be 50 people on set. And this is at a farm in the middle of fucking nowhere. And it's, you know, and it's things like that. And like, this is the job of the producer, is to figure out where the hell the porta potties are and to get them back on set. You know what I mean? That's not the gaffer's job. That's not the director's job. That's not the PA's job. That's, you know, I mean, that kind of rolls back down to the producer.
Yeah, so I think that's what a lot of people don't realize. So the role of the producer is more like, you're kind of like the project manager of the whole, yeah, of everything.
Well, and what's interesting is that what is kind of cool to me is the parallels between producing the film and all the catering I did. Because when I used to cater all these big parties back in the day, I wasn't just the chef. I cooked everything because it's my food. But there were about 50 moving parts that all had different shelf lives to culminate in a 5-minute window of when you're serving a plate of food and people are going to eat it in 5 minutes. But that 5 minutes takes 2 weeks of preparation, 3 days of ass-busting work. But really, you know, if you came to me and said, hey, I want, you know, I have a birthday party, I want you to cater, it would take 2 weeks to put it together, you know, from the very start of like coming up with a plan, starting to contact, like, okay, we come up with a plan, then I have to think about, like, oh, I got to hire all the people to be there. Some of the people I have to bring with me to location. We have to talk about rentals, and I have to start making phone calls. And then, like, 2 days before the event is when I shop. 3 days before I shop, 2 days and a day before I'm prepping and getting everything done. And then the day of, you're just like, it's just like insanity. And it comes down to, it's all about 5 minutes of when that food comes out and hits the plate and they eat, take the first couple bites.
Mm-hmm. And that's what people's impression becomes. They don't think about all of those weeks or days ahead of what happened, but it's just a matter of what's in front of them at that moment.
Yeah, they're sitting there eating. That's all that matters to the person who's eating. And it's the same thing with like a film. Like we went and watched Wonder Woman last night. And Charlie and I, and, you know, it's a 2.5 hour, that's the meal. But what went into that 2.5 hours is
years,
like
years a
couple
work. Yeah.
years of work. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And the producer's role is the same thing as my role was when I have my catering company. It's pretty much the same thing. It's just a different type of event. But this is like, there's all these moving parts on a film. And it's putting all the moving parts and all the assets together to produce something that's a 2.5 hour or 2 hour or 1 hour episode. It's all about coming down and producing that little chunk. And it's crazy because you wouldn't, because most of the people that are on the film are specialists. They're not like, the producer is one of the few people on the set that's not really, the producers and the PAs are really the non-specialists mm-hmm. on the set. Everybody else has a very specific yeah. job. You know, if you're the gaffer,
actresses, the cameraman,
yeah.
sound engineer. Yeah, everyone has a specific role.
The scroop sip, or the...
The what?
Soup, the script soup. Sorry, that's my dyslexia fucking with me.
What yeah. is that? What is that?
The job? Script supervisor.
They just... What are they?
They read the script as everything's being acting. They take photographs of the set all the time to make sure continuity... Their job is really...
Is that the same as a continuity person, or...
Well, sometimes, if you have a bigger budget, you have more people. Uh-huh. We had one script supervisor. She might have had, I don't remember, it was a blur, but she might have had a PA that okay. worked with
so,
her.
So they're making sure that just all the scenes are getting shot, all the lines are being set as written.
Yeah.
And once it's done, then you move to the next scene or next.
Yeah, and they can, I mean, script supervisors can do as much as take notes on each take. So that way, when the editor is sitting there with all the footage, they have, you don't want to lay a feature film worth of footage on an editor with zero notes, right?
Yeah, that's like, because that's days of footage.
A nightmare. Fucking days. Yeah. Hour, 20, 30, 40 hours of yeah. footage. You know mm-hmm. what I mean? Like, you don't want to lay that down. So your script soup is basically, they make sure all the lines are being said the right way. They make sure there's continuity. They take photographs of each scene. You know, they take photographs of the monitor. They take photographs of the set. So that way, if they have to go back, because you almost never shoot in chronological order.
Yeah, yeah.
So say you're doing, you know, one setup one day, and then 2-3 days later, you're doing the other side of the same setup. It makes it so that you can get continuity, but they also take notes and all that stuff. But that's a highly specialized. That person will never think about toilets, and should never think about toilets. Just like the actor should never think about where the dressing room is or setting up a tent for catering. You know, the producer's job, I mean, it sounds glamorous when you're in the theater and you see it come up.
Your name is one of the first ones to show up. Yeah.
But the fact of the matter is the producers are like, you're just like a glorified, you're a highly glorified PA is what you are. You know what I mean? Because you're running around just like problem solving and making sure that everything's, you're managing. Yeah, you're like a project manager. I mean, there are unit, you know, you have a UPM, unit project manager, which kind of is like a manager. The first assistant director kind of also is a managing, you know, there's a number of people on the set that do have managing duties, you know what I mean? But the producer's kind of the overarching, you know, the producers, if there's multiple, you know, you're the eyes on everything, making sure that everybody has what they need to do their job effectively. And that includes toilets and it includes food and it includes like parking spaces and it includes, you know, generator runs out of gas because we didn't bring an extra gas uh-huh. can. You have to race around town and get some gas. I mean, you know, it's any number of things. You know,
yeah.
Someone has their period and forgets to bring a tampon. You got to go fishing for tampons. You know what I mean? Like, it could be, that actually is one of the only
always,
things that
you
didn't
happen. Be prepared for anything, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, I want to keep talking to you, but we got to start getting towards the end.
Sure.
So for someone that's listening and is interested in getting into video production, whether it's being the camera side or director, producer side, but what advice can you give to someone that wants to start out now and get into the video industry?
I think number one is, well, a couple things. I think one is you want to think about, like, you're getting in, you're going to be on both sides of the fence, but you really, as soon as you can, start thinking about what side of the fence are you creative side or are you technical side? And if you're leaning in one direction, the faster you get good at one thing, the better it's going to be for your wallet. Because on a small potatoes level, you're going to be doing everything. But if you want to make real money at this thing, the people that make real money are the people that specialize in one thing. You know, like, they can do, I mean, anybody that's in the industry now, I mean, 30 years ago, you could be a sound guy that's never picked up a camera. You know what I mean? But nowadays, everybody's going to have experience with everything to some degree. But the people that make the money, if you want to make a career at this, I think that the best advice I could give someone is, you know, as soon as you can figure out what you're good at and what you're and what you like to do and specialize in it, because then the more specialized you are, the higher your rate's going to end up being. Make your work. That's a big finished work can sell. Unfinished work doesn't sell, period. So if you're interested in features, I think put your dramatic opus on the back table and focus on telling stories in the horror genre. Because horror films, you don't need name talent, and you can shoot them, you know, you can shoot a feature, a Hollywood style feature for $500,000. If it's a horror film, you're gonna have a really good chance of selling it, and at least making your money back. And you need to think about this when you're bringing in. And it doesn't matter if the investor is someone you don't know or is a family member. If they're your parents, they're an investor, and you have to treat them as if you don't know them, and you know that there's a consequence if you don't return their money. Another thing that I think is super important is your team. You know, that is probably the biggest thing I've learned in my life, especially in the last, and it's funny because you and I have met through startup. There is not one startup I can think of that's successful in town that doesn't have this one thing in common with all the other successful, and it's that they have a great team.
Mm-hmm. Yep,
you can have a mediocre product, an average application. If you have a really, really great team, it's going to do well. If you could have a brilliant idea, and if you're a shithead or you have shitheads on your team, it won't go anywhere.
Mm-hmm, exactly.
And you and I have been to enough of these events to know that, like, it's not, it's 100%, it's guaranteed, you know, it's about the team. So I would say to a young person getting, or any age person getting into this, it's like, start thinking about your team and really study and know the people you're working with. And make sure that they have, you know, my focus now is making sure that the people I'm working with have the same principles that I have, that conduct business the same way that I would want to conduct business. Because if you're, it's one thing to make a commercial with someone. I've made commercials with some of the worst fucking people ever. And it's like, after you shoot for the day and you deliver some edits, it's over. When you're in the trenches with someone for 24, 25, 26 days making a film that has a $650,000 budget that you can't back out of, then
or,
you really...
Or can't ask for more money.
Can't ask for more money. And if you back out halfway through, you're boning someone on their humongous investment. You can't do that. And so it's... I can't stress enough how important the team is. When you're in the trenches for that, it's like a long-term relationship.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
You know, commercial, you and I doing a video, that's like a one-night stand. You can put up with the worst because you're going to kick them out in one night. And I know that's a horrible reference, but it's true. And I mean, it's, you know, but like a film or something like that, that's a long-term relationship. So it can't just be about looks. It's got to be about every aspect of your partnerships.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say, partnership. Yeah, because it is a partnership.
Total partnership. And you're committed. When there's $650,000 on the line and this shoot's 25 days, let me tell you, you're committed. There's no way out of that.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? And you have to deliver a film. I mean, you make a restaurant. You know, Cameron Mitchell spends $650,000 opening a restaurant.
After it opens, it has to make money.
Yeah, that's a restaurant, right? And then in the film world, that's like that's not even a low budget film. That's lower than low budget film, but that's still a huge amount of money, and you're responsible for that money. And so, in my opinion, you got to give yourself the best as a filmmaker. You've got to give yourself the best chances of getting through that alive. And there's nothing that will. From my experience, there's nothing that will crush that more than a bad team. So teamwork, again, so thinking about who your team is going to be. Because if you're going to make more than like small, you know, like little videos for small shops on High Street, you have to think, which there's nothing wrong with that, but if you want to make more money than $500 for a video or $1,000, you have to think about your team. You have to build a team, and you have to build the right team. And my experience level at this point in my life, it's not about the person's skill set. That helps and it's necessary, but the most important thing is what are the person's principles? What kind of person are they? You know, and mm-hmm. If you're on the same page with that person, then you can start building something.
Yeah, and that's good advice. I mean, and that's relevant to just about any industry.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Anything.
Well, cool. And I know before we started recording, we were talking about social media. So where can people find out more about you, or where can people reach you?
Well, I'm just old school. I have websites, but I don't think people look at websites anymore. So, and my girlfriend Charlie was ragging on me last night for not having a better Twitter and Instagram, because you have to post that stuff every day.
Yeah, and you have to market yourself.
Which is hard, because it's like, God, there's so many other things I'm doing. It's like, and I just don't, I mean, you know, I don't think I'm that interesting comparatively. You know what I mean? Like, the projects I like to work on, I think, are interesting. But it's like, every day, what the hell am I going to take a picture of, right? But the thing that's interesting is that, I don't remember where I heard this, but when we were on set filming, the Instagram following on the actors that we were using had an impact on their ability to be on the set. And I believe it also had an impact on their pay. I wasn't in control of that, but I actually heard that.
That makes sense.
It makes sense. But what was amazing to me is that it was like, are you kidding? Because some people have bigger Instagram followings, even though they're not as big name of an actor. But it's like the fact that that even plays, it just seemed crazy to me that the social media application would factor into something as serious as someone's pay rate, right?
No, that's the world we live in nowadays.
It is the world we live in. So it makes me think about, like, you know, as a director, as a producer, that could also have an impact. Like, if I had a, you know, like right now, I think I have 300 or 400 followers on my Instagram page, because I've only I've only posted three posts, and that was like 4 years ago. And I have 300 or 400 people on my thing. My girlfriend's Instagram page has over 1,000. Our DP on our set has 18,000 followers, our cinematographer, you know, and companies will send him, you know, $10,000 lighting kits just because they want him to shoot.
Oh.
Yeah, to test it. He gets to keep it. And he shoots with it. You know, one of the lighting kits we used for the film was a lighting kit that he was sent to by a company that wanted him to use his stuff.
Yeah.
And crazy shit,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
And some of the actors, like, you know, they have like 20, 30,000 followers. You know, it's interesting, because it's like, that's the world we live in. It's like, you have to think about this. And it's kind of like, it's challenging for me, because it's like, I'm not an actor. I'm a producer. So it's kind of like my girlfriend's a model sometimes. She does modeling. So I get it. Her photos are of her modeling. That's a product.
I mean, that is her work.
That is her work. An actor, same thing. They're on the set. That is their work. For me, it's kind of like, do people seriously want to see me sitting around, like a photo of me sitting there writing a list? Because that's pretty much all I do.
Well, you don't have to necessarily show yourself working, but show what you're working on.
Yeah, but again, today I'm trying to figure out where the fucking toilets are. Do you know what I mean? Is that Instagram worthy?
Maybe.
Well, I don't know. Maybe it is. I have to figure this out, because I only have 200, 300. I think my grandmother has as many Twitter or Instagram followers as I do. So I got to figure this out, because it could impact my...
Oh, definitely. Yeah.
You know, and it's just like, God damn, you know, just when you think you might have a finger on it, and then you find out you have nothing.
Yeah.
In a different area you never knew was important. So I don't know.
Well, so for people that are listening to this episode, maybe a year from now, maybe a few months from now, so when they do listen to his work, can they find how to follow your work?
Just type in Kita Mascaro, because there's nobody on the planet that has that name except me.
Okay, that's good. Yeah, and I'll put it in the show notes as well.
So if you look up whatever, you know, in 10 years, you probably do it with your brain. There'll probably be some implant in the brain. Just think about me and it'll pull up something hopefully interesting.
Okay. Well, thanks, Keita, for being here.
Thank you.
I like hearing your stories, and I know we've been working together a long time, but
yeah you're awesome. And this is a huge, anybody listening, you're a real, like, I love working with you.
Oh, no, I thank you. I appreciate it.
Yeah, no, and I appreciate this thing. And I think that, you know, I'm excited for the kind of, speaking to team, I mean, I'm excited about us working together on some projects too. Mm-hmm. So
thank you. And so my last question, how would you describe yourself in 5 words or less?
Okay, I think it's 5 words. I have no fucking idea. Is that 5 words?
That's good enough, yeah. That's fine.
No fucking idea. Yeah, that's 5.
Oh, right on. Well, thanks again, Keita.
All right, thank you.
I look forward to working with you more and just seeing what you do in the future. Best of luck.
Yeah, and anybody who's listening, I mean, I'm pretty accessible. If you have any questions, just like go on to the internets and find me.
Yeah. You know, yeah, again, I'll put your name in the show notes so people know how to spell it and how to find you. And so hopefully we'll get some people reach out to you after this.
All right, cool.
Thanks for listening to the Creative Pursuit Podcast. Find us online at creativepursuit.co. Don't forget to subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you listen to podcasts. And if you enjoyed the show, we would greatly appreciate your review. It only takes a few minutes, but it really helps support the show and keep it going. Until next time, we encourage you to start pursuing your creative passion today.